Go.
Good evening. This is Will Doggett, K3SRF. Tonight we're working on the technician licensing class, Lesson 3, presented by the Arlington Radio Public Service Club in Arlington County, Virginia. And in the last class, we went over sub-elements T3, T4, and T5 from the question pool for the technician licensing tests. We could just ask some questions about things that we know. There's some areas that are covered with so many questions that we can be sure there'll be one or two. And one of such groups is about the ionosphere and about radio wave propagation. And here's an example of one of the questions. What is the usual cause of sky wave propagation? And the choices are, signals are reflected by a mountain, by the moon, signals are transmitted by a repeater, or signals are bent back to Earth by the ionosphere.
The last one.
Yeah, that would be it. Signals are bent back by the ionosphere. You get that area down cold, you're pretty good that you've got a few good answers. Here's another one. When a signal travels in a straight line from one antenna to another, what is this called? Is that tunnel ducting, knife edge diffraction, straight line propagation, or line of sight propagation? The building, they can be bent by the ionosphere, they can be reflected by the building, or they can be polarized by the building's mass.
They're reflected.
They're reflected by the building, and that's why these big condominiums and office buildings at Arlington make it hard to get out sometimes with VHF signals. So we don't have to spend too much time on that. I just wanted to throw a few at you. Here's another one that I've seen a few times on the test about antennas. What's the height restriction that the FCC places on amateur radio antennas without registration with the FCC and the Federal Aviation Administration? What's the height restriction without special registration?
200 feet.
200 feet it is. So you're allowed to put up a tower that high if you think it's a good idea. Okay, let's go on to the sub-elements that we're going to work on tonight, which is starting with sub-element T6, good operating practices. And I'm on slide 3 at that point. And then slide 4 is the first one where it talks about a band plan. And band plans are voluntary, but they're widely used in the amateur community. In fact, the FCC kind of refers to them unofficially as good amateur practice. And on the slide, number 4 there, it shows a typical band plan for the 6-meter band. And usually at the low end of the band on VHF are weak signal services like CW, that is Morse code, single sideband, and then other parts of the band are referenced or kind of allocated for different services, including repeaters and other functions. So usually groups of amateurs put together these band plans, a committee. There's a couple in our area. One is the Mid-Atlantic and another the Southeastern repeater associations that kind of divide up the band and make that plan. And that's been, there's one or two questions that refer to a band plan. That's what it is, a voluntary guideline for using different modes in the ham bands and kind of dividing up so that they don't interfere with one another. So that's a good idea to have those. I usually just print up a copy off the internet and have it in my notebook. So on the next slide, it says, before you transmit. This is something every ham should know, but if you listen to the radio, you find that there's some that don't. Before you transmit, listen first. And if you don't hear anything, it could be just the way your antenna's pointed or some other feature, but the right practice is to give a quick call and say, is this frequency in use? And then you need to give your call sign because you don't want to make an unidentified transmission. So you just say, is this frequency in use? This is K3SRF. And if for some reason somebody else has just paused for a few seconds, or if you don't hear them, they may come back and say, yes, we've got a QSO in progress, or we're running a net, or whatever they're doing, and then you may want to find a new place. But that's the polite thing to do, and it's good amateur practice, to listen first, and on HF particularly, to ask if that frequency is in use. And then after you get your license, the most fun thing is calling CQ on the HF bands. That's something that's been used for decades by hams. The original meaning is lost in history, but it means calling any station. So on HF, single sideband, you can just call CQ a few times, and then this is, and then your own call letters. Or on Morse code, they use DE, which is French for from, CQ, 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 DE, K3SRF, a few times. So that's a way to call to any station, asking them to respond to you to set up a contact. And there's a couple questions about doing just that, initiating a contact, they call it. And one of the points is not to call CQ over and over again. If somebody else is tuning the bands and they hear you call CQ, they want to answer. They don't want to hear you say CQ 25 times before they get a chance to transmit. So 4 or 5 times is enough. Then DE and on Morse code, or from, this is in voice, and then your call sign. So that's the way it's done on HF frequencies. On VHF and UHF, it's a little different. Many of us are using FM on the VHF, such as the 2-meter and 6-meter bands. And usually you've got a little clearer signal. So you can call the other station if you know who they are. Say, call their call sign, and then this is, and then your call sign, or just theirs first, pause, and then yours. Or if you don't know who's out there, you can just say, this is K3SRF listening or monitoring. Just to let other people know that you're sitting there, and if somebody else is listening also, they can set up a contact. So those are some simple practices that you'll soon put to use when you get your license, but there's a couple questions on them also. And another important thing to note, which is also something we use a lot in RACES, is the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU phonetic alphabet. And at first it seems kind of intimidating, but it's actually pretty simple. And after you use it a few times, it almost just jumps into your mind when you're looking for the letters. That's the Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, and all that for the different alphabet. And there's a couple that have unusual pronunciations. The main one is Quebec. The French-Canadian province of Quebec is pronounced as if it started with a K, but that's actually the phonetic word for the letter Q. And Kilo, the letter K is Kilo. Letter L is Lima, like Lima, Ohio. It's not the lima bean. Otherwise, they're pretty clear-cut. So that's, again, a good thing to know, and you might get a question for it. And that's used when band conditions are noisy or crowded and there might be some interference, and they're used around the world. So that's something that you can use to communicate with hams in other countries, and that's why we use the ITU phonetic alphabet. Rather than just making up some letters that sound cool with your call letters, hams in other countries may have difficulty speaking English, but they can learn that alphabet, and they'll be able to communicate with you. So that's why we stick to the ITU alphabet. And hams have a zillion abbreviations and little catchphrases that they use. Many of them were originally used on Morse code, where it was important to have brief ways of expressing oneself. But hams still use them a lot, and some of the ones are listed on this next slide, which is number 9. Is that right? No, 3, 6.
I have 10.
Yep, 10 is right. So 73 is best regards, 88, love and kisses. DX means a distant station. Often on HF, we're talking about a station in another country often. Somebody said, I'm looking for DX. They mean a station overseas typically. And on Morse code, means go ahead to any station, transmit. And again on Morse code, QRS means send more slowly. But the way that stations figure how quickly they should send Morse code is how fast you send. So that's kind of their cue. But there's a question about that a little later on. Another phrase you might hear is your signal is full quieting. And that means that the signal is strong enough that it's stronger than, it covers up all the receiver noise we use on FM. So your signal is coming in, is filling the audio from that receiver. It's full quieting. So that means you're loud and clear. Another thing that's used widely by hams is the signal strength reporting system. They call the RST system, which stands for readability, signal strength, and tone. And the tone refers for Morse code, for CW only, because the tone had to do with it. We were having a nice clear signal, or could you hear a ripple, like an AC alternating current sound coming through your power supply if you were doing Morse code. So now, for most of us, we're using the RS part of it, the readability 1 through 5, and then signal strength 1 through 9. And many receivers and transceivers have a signal strength meter on them, right on the front of the receiver, and that's what they're showing on slide 12. So that S meter, they call it, a signal strength meter, gives a relative signal strength reading. And it goes up to S9, and then it has plus 20, plus 30, plus 40 decibels. So that gives the signal strength in decibels greater than 9. So somebody could say your signal strength is S9 plus 20 dB. Or in the example on slide 12, it says a report of 5.9 plus 20 dB, readability 5, that is good, and the signal strength 20 decibels over S9. And then one of the questions addresses that example specifically. So that's what we're talking about, readability and signal strength. QSL cards, many hams have great fun collecting usually postcards from other stations with which they've had a contact, a QSO, where they've sent and received information with that other station, and then they get a card listing that specific contact, that date and time, frequency and mode. And then many hams like to enter contests and say, I've contacted hams in all these counties, all these states, or all these different countries. And the QSL card is an acknowledgement of that. So technically, it's a written acknowledgement of communication between two amateurs. It could even be a letter or something else, typically a postcard. But in the question, the phrasing is exactly that. It's a written acknowledgement. On slide 14, a ham station used to connect other amateur radio stations to the internet is called a gateway. A specific question there. On slide 15, we're talking about the bandwidth. Again, there's several questions about bandwidth, so that's a good idea to have a picture in your mind what we're talking about. And the bandwidth is literally that. It's the width of a signal in kilohertz or some other measurement, but basically in the width of a signal on the radio frequency spectrum. How much space is that signal taking up? And the graph on slide 15 is very clear, and that's the good one to have in mind. So the simplest signal is almost just the carrier wave being turned on and off. That's CW. Used to be called continuous wave. That's where they got the name CW. And that's Morse code. That's just the narrowest signal, 500 hertz wide. So you can have a really narrow filter on your receiver and just pick out that signal amongst a lot of other interfering signals. That's why it's the clearest and easiest to receive. So that's the narrowest. You can get a lot of CW signals in a ham band. The next widest is radio teletype, RTTY, some people call it, about 1.5 kilohertz. Single sideband, about 3 kilohertz. And an FM signal, the reason the FM signals are used up on the VHF and UHF bands is those bands are bigger. And they're generally relatively short distance. So in a local area, it's not a problem if a ham signal takes up 20 kilohertz. Down on the 40-meter HF band, it would be a big problem if you took up that much space because so many hams are using it. On VHF and UHF, there's more space. So there's some good figures to kind of keep in mind. A CW signal about 500 hertz, 3 kilohertz for sideband, up to about 20 kilohertz for FM. And there's several questions that address bandwidth. And they've got some pictures here on the upcoming slides. that show what that might look like. If you have, if your transceiver has a little scope, is what it amounts to, like sort of like an oscilloscope that shows what the signal looks like, it might look like this. On slide 16, a sideband signal, you can actually see the width of it. The RIDI signal a little narrower, and a CW signal just the narrowest little band. Several questions talk about interference, because that's one of the things from the earliest days of ham radio. Hams want to make sure that they have a clean signal, that they're not interfering with their neighbors' radios or TVs or stereos or whatever it might be, nor are they interfering with other hams or other radio services. Right away, one of the things you need to know about that is about harmonics, that many kinds of transmitters can generate harmonics, which are multiples of the transmitted frequency. Or on slide 17, they call it the desired frequency. The desired frequency is what you're trying to transmit. But many types of transmitters can inadvertently generate a second, a third, and even higher harmonics, which are 2 and 3 and 4 times that frequency. So the FCC regulations give specific limits of the levels that you're allowed to do. The harmonics have got to be way, way much less powerful than your desired frequency transmission. And who's responsible for keeping that clear? That's your job as a ham radio operator, to make sure that your transmitter does not produce harmonics. So this is likely to be a question about that. Another type of interference they talk about on slide 18 is splatter. That can happen on sideband and other modes with voice. Basically, if you've got the microphone audio amplifier turned up too high, because you can only get 100% modulation. Once you get more than that, you're actually making a poorly sounding signal. You think you're turning it up higher to get a better signal, but really you're getting it too much modulation and it distorts the signal. And that's what they're talking about, splatter. And the little picture of it on the scope on slide 18 shows that that actually is making a wider signal with some interference. If you're a rock and roll band, you're trying to make weird sounds, you may turn your guitar amplifiers up to more than 100%. But if you're trying to make a clear transmission, that's not what you want. A common thing that hams have to look out for is TV interference. In fact, it's so common they sometimes just say TVI. That's what we're talking about. So the thing to do is to think about what's causing that if you're getting TV interference. The quick way to find out right away is to see if it's causing interference to your own TV. So it's possible that harmonic radiation from your transmitter is causing interference, and if that's the case, that's your responsibility. Because if you know what frequency you're transmitting on, it's easy to calculate the harmonics, because it's literally multiplied by 2 times 3 times 4, and you can look up to see where the TV station frequencies are. The lower TV frequencies are near the 6-meter ham band. They're in the 50 megahertz, between 50 and 60 megahertz. Then the higher channels are up around FM radio, over 100 megahertz. So you can multiply your frequency and see if you're in the area where you could be causing interference to those TV stations. And if you are, there's several types of solutions. If you're the cause, it's your responsibility. So one of the things you can use is a low-pass filter. And speaking for myself, I always found it confusing. When they talk about a low-pass filter, you have to think a filter is reducing signals of a certain frequency. So a low-pass filter is reducing higher frequencies. It's passing, and it's allowing the low frequencies. So that's the trick. It says low pass means it's allowing the low frequencies. It's filtering or cutting down the higher frequencies. So if you had an HF transmitter that you were concerned that might be giving off harmonics, you use a low pass filter that would allow your transmitted signal, your desired frequency, to pass. It would filter out the higher frequencies. So since there are several questions about that, it's good to have a picture in your mind of what they're talking about, the filters. And they talk about a couple different types. A low-pass filter that shows in the graph on slide 21, there's the signal. It shows it on the red line, and then it shows it what a picture on a scope would actually look like. So the Lopez filter blocks the energy above a level, above a certain frequency. So your frequency of your desired frequency is there at 0 dB, and then where the filter cuts in, it makes the signal much lower. And they've got a couple other pictures in the future slides to show a similar situation. So that's what a low-pass filter does. It allows the low frequency through, filters the higher ones. And then there's a graphic picture on slide 22, what TVI looks like. It could be interfering, making bands of light across the TV screen. It could be receiver overload.
How does that sound?
It could be that your transmitter is just overloading the front end of that TV receiver, making those interference signals. So if you're doing that, it's really the owner of the TV who's responsible. But in good practice, most hams try to help out their neighbors and not trying to be a nuisance to the neighborhood. So even though it's, you could say it's the TV's fault, hams usually try to help out and see if they can give some advice about that. So it could be going directly to the TV. Another way a signal could be getting in is a break in the cable TV line that would allow it to pick up signals from your ham transmitting antenna. And again, the solution is proposed right away. That's on slide 23, a high-pass filter. So here's kind of the opposite of what we were talking about before. This is for a filter for your neighbor's TV. So a high-pass filter goes between their TV and their TV antenna. And in that case, it would be allowing the high frequencies, the TV signals, through. It would be filtering or reducing the lower frequency that's causing the interference from your ham station. So the question says that's the first step. If you've got a problem where it seems like it's probably radio frequency overload from the ham transmitter, a high-pass filter would be a, kind of the first option to try to solve that problem. And on the next slide, it shows, again, a graph and a picture from a scope of what that looks like. A high-pass filter blocks the radio frequency energy below a certain frequency, allows the higher frequency TV signals to get through. And then one more type of filter would be a band-pass filter that cuts down both higher and lower frequencies, but allows that fairly narrow band to pass through. So the text on slide 25 says it blocks radio frequency energy above and below, and it can be used to block interference from a strong transmitter that's near you. So if this one that's interfering with you, you can use a filter of this type to just allow the frequencies out that you want out and block other ones above and below. Some of the questions also address other possible interference problems, and they include telephones. Some telephones have a problem, and the real issue is that telephones were not designed to deal with strong radio signals. Or spurious radiation from an HT, a handheld transceiver, could interfere with signals on a nearby frequency. Good term, spurious. That's one. The only place I've ever heard that used is in ham radio. Spurious radiation, we're trying to avoid that. It has a few other uses, like the Secret Service has discovered a team of gangsters who have been issuing spurious $20 bills, counterfeit. So here, spurious radiation means radiation, and we don't want to allow that. And something else that could be a problem is in the power supply. A power supply that's making DC, say 12-volt DC from the 120-volt AC house current, if it has a bad filter capacitor, it could allow hum. Instead of making nice DC, it's giving out direct current that's got a little ripple in it, and that can make a hum or buzz on your transmissions. So those three are described in slide 26. So those are some things to watch out. So we talked about possible types of TV interference and then filters or other corrective action that we could take to try to fix those. So now we're going to go on to sub-element T7, basic communication electronics, and the keyword is basic. So we just talk about a few types of components and how they're measured, just so that you have a little bit of understanding of the elements that make up electronic devices. One of the things to know right off the bat is what the numbering system is. Because when the units were first devised, some of them were too big and some of them were too small. And so now we have to divide and multiply to make them applicable. So we're using for hertz is the signal for frequency, but obviously in the ranges we're talking about in high frequency, we're talking about kilohertz, megahertz, and for UHF signals on up above that. So the metric units, it's important to know what those are just to kind of get them in mind. Gigahertz, 10 to the 9, or times a billion. Megahertz, 10 to the 6th power, or a million. Kilo, 10 to the 3rd, or times 1,000. And then for fractional ones, milli, like milliwatt, 1,000th of a watt, 10 to the minus 3, or 1,000th. Micro, 10 to the minus 6th power, or 1 millionth, like one microfarad capacitor. Or picofarad, 10 to the minus 12. So those are good ones to know, and then they give some examples on slide 29 of where they might be used, like we were just talking about kilohertz. And then to be able to transfer from megahertz to kilohertz. Those are the most common ones when we're talking about frequency. So something that's at 3.525 megahertz is 3,525 kilohertz. So it's good to be able to go back and forth. Sometimes we just use one phrase more commonly. Like often people say 500 milliwatts. You'll have the family radio service little handheld transmitters are 500 milliwatts. That's half a watt. So we should go on, but that's just something to review in your mind until you've got those down. And you can be sure there's going to be a few questions about voltage and current in Ohm's law. So just to cover the basics there, current is the flow of electrons on an electric circuit, often compared to the flow of water in a pipe. And the unit of current is amps. Sometimes they say intensity is measured in amperes. Electromotive force, EMF, or voltage, is what pushes the electrons through the circuit. And often the analogy is made to the pressure of water in a pipe. And for voltage, we're measuring volts. That's on slide 30. Slide 31, conductors. There's a couple questions about conductors. Materials that allow the flow of electrons easily, such as metals, the precious metals, gold and silver, are often used even computers and even in radio connectors because they're such good conductors. More common in regular wiring, copper, sometimes aluminum. Most metals, even mercury, liquid metal, are good conductors. And the opposite of a conductor, of course, would be an insulator. And another type of component we want to be aware of is resistor. So slide 32, we talk about resistance. Resistance is opposing the flow of electrons. So there's pictured different types of resistors, little carbon resistors with bands of different color that give what their values are, then larger resistors that are often wire wound. You can see like the coils of wire in the picture on slide 32. And variable resistors, like the one in the top left of the picture, sometimes called a potentiometer or a rheostat. It's a variable resistor. So the resistance limits the current that can flow through a circuit compared to a restriction in a water pipe. And the ohm, O-H-M, is the basic unit of resistance. At the bottom of slide 32, it shows the electronic schematic symbols for resistor, which is just a jagged line back and forth, or if it shows an arrow pointing into it, that means it's a variable resistor or potentiometer. And one of the interesting things about electronic components is they can be described with math. And on slide 33, one of those examples is adding resistors. If you've got two resistors in series, that's basically just like one big resistor, so they're added. The total resistance is equal to R1 plus R2. However, if the two resistors are in parallel, you can picture in your mind, it's a different situation. The electrons have two paths to go through there, and the sum, the total resistance, is the product. The two resistors multiplied together divided by the quantity that they're added together. So the product divided by the sum is the total resistance if they're in parallel. That's just one you kind of have to remember. But it's just an example of one of the things where you can describe with a math function what the components are doing. On slide 34, we want to be able to measure voltage and current. So we have a little schematic of a battery and a resistor. At the far left is a battery. It shows the positive and negative poles. At the far right, a resistor labeled R. And we can say it's possible to have voltage without a current. So we have the voltage of the battery, but in order to have a current, there's got to be a circuit, and the circuit is completed by connecting to that resistor. And then the meter, the yellow circle, could be an ammeter to measure the current passing through that point. And this is leading up to Ohm's law. This is something new hands have struggled with for many years, but I'm sure that you can handle it. But it's good to practice. You know there'll be a question or two about this, so it's good to have it down. Ohm's law is a formula that shows the relationship between voltage or electromotive force. That's why they get the E for EMF, electromotive force, or voltage, current, or the intensity of the electrons, and resistance, R. And Ohm's law is simple, that voltage equals current times resistance. And in the examples on these slides, it gives a little memory device, which is a circle. You see the yellow circle with E above, I, and R. And that's the way to make the formula. Once you figure out what they're talking about in your mind, to think about the previous slide, E equals I times R. So if you take E off the little circle, E equals, and then I and R on the same level, so they're multiplied together. If you were to take R out, R equals E over I. Or if you take I out of it, I equals E divided by R. We'll see those in the coming examples. So Ohm's law, the volts, I, the flow of electrons in amps, R, the resistance in ohms. So let's go ahead to slide 37 and look at the first example. So on 37, again, it's showing a battery of 200 volts and a resistor of 100 ohms. And the question is, what's the unknown? What's the current through that resistor? If we put an ammeter in that circuit, what would be the current? So if we start with that little circle, we're trying to find the current, or I. So we take the I out of there, and that leaves E over R. So that's the memory device. I equals E over R. So E is 200 volts divided by 100 ohms equals 2 amps. So we just need to practice those or get used to those questions so you can use the little memory device. Of course, that device won't be on the questions, but once you get started with your test, you can just write it in a corner and remember it. On slide 38, another example, we don't know the voltage of the battery, but we do know that we've got 2 amps of current through a 50-ohm resistor. So what we want to know is E, the voltage. So E equals I times R, 2 amps times 50 ohms, so that battery must be 100 volts. And yet another exercise on slide 39, here the unknown is the resistor. We've got a battery of 90 volts. We're using 3 amps. So we're looking for the resistance. R equals E divided by I, the voltage divided by the current. So it's 90 divided by 3 equals 30 ohms of resistance. So it's almost certain there'll be one or more of those questions will be on the test. So it's good to be able to do that, those little Ohm's law problems. Another unit that's good to know is decibel on slide 40. A decibel is a comparison figure. A decibel is a comparison of two power levels. And the definition of it, don't let it trip you up here. It's 10 times the logarithm of the two power levels, P2 divided by P1. So in the example, real easy. If P1 is 5 watts, P2 is 10 watts. So we're making a comparison of one signal that's twice as strong as the other, 10 divided by 5. So their ratio is 2. The logarithm of 2, that's the log to the base 10, is 0.3. And 10 times that is 3 decibels. So that there's the comparison. If something is twice as loud as the previous signal, it's an increase of 3 decibels. So that's what it says at the bottom. Remember, every 3 dB increase is the same as doubling the power. A 3 dB decrease is the same as halving the power. And the reason we use the logarithm is for things like signals and for other types of things, like in audio, something, if you're hearing something and another sound sounds twice as loud, the actual sound pressure is much greater, but you can measure it in decibels and have it in units that are easier to handle. So the decibel, remember, is a comparison of two signal strengths. 3 dB is the same as doubling the power. That's a good memory device.
Well,
on slide 41.
Well,
yes, sir.
Another point to make there is that the human ear typically cannot detect a difference in sound less than 3 dB. So if somebody says to you, does it sound any better now, and you don't hear the difference, the chances are that whatever the difference was not quite 3 dB.
Good point.
If you didn't hear it. So in a practical sense.
If you're hearing, if you can't hear the difference, it's going to be less than 3 dB.
Could be less than 3 dB, but then there are other circuits which may affect what you hear, but typically the human ear can only distinguish differences in volume at increments of 3 dB. Thanks.
Yep. Your ear can hear differences of 3 dB or greater. So if it's less than that, you might not even hear the difference. So that's, again, the reason why we're using decibels is because those are differences that we can detect with our own senses. On slide 41, we're showing schematics of different types of switches. And they actually show a picture of different knife switches, the real simple ones, so you can see what the poles look like. And the simplest one at the top left